Okay. Our next presentation is entitled Dayton Miller, an Early Mechanical Acoustical Analysis. The two speakers are William Fickinger and Peter Hokya. Bill Fickinger did his graduate work at Yale and spent the next 30 years doing research in experimental particle physics at Case Western Reserve. After reaching emeritus status, he became interested in the history of the CWRU Physics Department, which is, I guess, Case Western, right? Case Western Reserve, going back to the 1880s. He has published a book on that history, as well as an informal biography of Dayton Miller. Miller was chair at Case from 1890 till the 1930s. He left behind many instruments and documents related to his research, including that on acoustics and sound reproduction. Fickinger has enjoyed organizing Miller's collections and working with university archives for their preservation. The second speaker, Peter Hokya, is Associate Professor of Physics at Baldwin Wallace University in Berea, Ohio, where he teaches classes in acoustics, optics, and modern physics. Peter is also an avid musician, playing trumpet, flute, and other instruments, and his main research area is the physics of musical instruments. He obtained his BS and PhD in physics from Case Western Reserve, where he studied under the late Arthur Benaday. Benaday himself was mentored while on the Case faculty by Robert Shankland, who had been a student of Dayton Miller. So, in effect, Peter closes the loop by bringing the study of acoustics and musical instruments back to Baldwin Wallace. He and his former nuclear physics instructor, Bill Fickinger, have been collaborating on lecture demos about Dayton Miller since 2002. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Sarah. And good afternoon, all tech heads and archivists. We're all in the right spot. This is great. Yay! Okay, so we wanted to talk about acoustical analysis in the early 20th century. Part of that process includes recording sound, which is why it fits, I think, in this venue. And we're going to look at it from a scientific point of view. So Dayton Miller was on the physics faculty at Case. He did lots of really cool things, and so we couldn't resist talking a little bit about his background while we're at it. We're going to show you lots of pictures of really cool instruments that he worked on, including the phonodeic that he invented, and then we will look at some playback of his recorded sounds. So Dayton started out in Berea, Ohio, which is where Baldwin University and now Baldwin Wallace University is. His father had a hardware store, and young Dayton learned to use the tools in the tool room there. He also played piccolo because the flutes were too small for him when he was young, and eventually then flute. So all through his story, we will see this double story of his interest in science and building things, as well as his interest in music and his study of the musical instruments. He, among other things, was an avid reader of Scientific American, and when he read about the telephone, then he built one. And he built a fife, he built three telescopes in the hardware shop, and so forth. He studied then at Baldwin University in Berea. He graduated in 1886, and at his graduation, he gave a lecture on the sun, and he also played a flute solo. And I think he also gave another lecture on telescopes. So again, those two stories keep coming back over and over and again. After graduation from Baldwin University, his interest in astronomy took him to Princeton, where he studied with astronomer Charles Young, who had been actually in the Western Reserve some years earlier. His dissertation topic was the comet of 1889, which is just 1889 V, that had just been observed. He wrote an ephemeris. An ephemeris is one of these books that has a listing of lots of numbers that tells where exactly the comet or the planets or the sun will be at any point in time, in any day in the future. So you can see that that he's a person who really likes numbers. Astronomy in those days was all about trigonometry. And so in the process, then he had to really work with sines and cosines and so forth. And so he was really comfortable with all of those things. He was promised a fellowship to work at the observatory after he graduated, but the equipment was not quite ready, and so he went back to Ohio, and this is where Bill will pick up the talk.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here and to tell you some of the things we've learned about Dayton. I retired 15 years ago and sort of ended up as the self-appointed archivist and historian of the department. I wrote a book on the history of the department, and Miller was such an interesting part of it, I wrote a little book on him as well, and that's why we're here. Someone saw the book. And so let's see, where are we going? These are just some of the things, some pictures we had. As I said, Dayton saved everything. So all these pictures are in Dayton's files. I just found a postcard the other day that he got from the Physical Society Journal, the first volume. He bought a subscription for the year for $3. $3 for the year, anyway. So he saved everything. In the upper right-hand corner, there he is, over on the right-hand side, the little skinny guy with the mustache, and that's the faculty at Case School of Applied Sciences. And at the very beginning, he was hired in 1890, and he became chair in 1893, so he's only something like 27 years old. And in December of 1895, Röntgen published his first paper on X-rays. 3 months later, Miller is making X-rays, zapping himself there in the middle, and wrote a paper with Kreil, who is the founder of the Cleveland Clinic. And Miller and his assistant got out on the road. He just loved show business. He loved getting out and giving lectures, and you're going to see he's got 10 different topics to talk about. But the first round was X-rays, and he traveled up and down the country, and they would make X-rays of people there on the stage, okay? It wasn't a very healthy thing to do. And in fact, Edison was doing similar things, and his assistant died, and so did Miller's. So it was back to acoustics, but before we get to acoustics, I'll go down to the lower right-hand corner. In 1887, there was an experiment done at Case and Western Reserve. They're two separate institutions, called the Michelson-Morley experiment. You all hear about the Michelson-Morley experiment? It was an effort to show that the speed of light is different when measured in the direction that the Earth is going around the sun compared to right angles to that, because the Earth is moving at 1,000 miles an hour in its orbit around the sun, and if you could develop a very sensitive optical instrument to measure the speed difference, you could demonstrate that. And it was expected by everybody that they would see an effect. Michelson and Morley worked on it in 1887, published a paper, they did not see any effect. And the people, the famous physicists in Europe, they say, oh, come on, do it right. You have to see an effect. And so Michelson went on, he moved on to Chicago, and Miller shows up in Ohio, and he teamed up with Morley, and they started repeating the Michelson-Morley experiment. So now we're at 1904, so it's 15 years later. And there's the headline. Oh, wait a minute, I'm getting ahead of myself. Along comes this fellow named Einstein, who said, you will not see an effect. The speed of light is the same in all reference frames. Well, that's completely wacky. And all the famous physicists, Lord Rutherford and Lord Kelvin and you name it, they're all encouraging experimentalists all over the world, do the experiment right, let's see the effect. And then Einstein comes along and he says, no, the speed of light is the same in all reference frames. Well, that's just counterintuitive. That's wacky. And that's so Miller dives into that. X-rays are gone. Ether takes over. He's working on improving the Michelson-Morley experiment. He works with Morley. So now you can see the headline there. I can't see it. But, oh yeah, May dethrone Einstein. Okay? And so he's traveling up and down the country, and he goes out to California to a mountaintop and repeats the experiment for a good 15 years or so. Anyway, so we'll put the ether away for a while. Einstein came to Cleveland and visited and signed the guest book and so forth. But the whole world was waiting for Miller to prove that Einstein was wrong. Well, naturally, it didn't turn out that way. So then, flutes. As a student at Baldwin, he was very much enamored of flutes and their design and so forth. And so that's what really got him into the acoustics. Could he measure quantitatively the difference in sounds from different flutes made of different materials and so forth? And will we just hit the space bar? No, we'll hit it down. I'm looking for it. There we go. Okay, so now this device had been around for quite a while. There's one here, right here. It just had a gas line coming in here and a little flame. In some talks that we've given in the past, we had a tank of gas and a little flame, but we didn't think the hotel people would be very happy with that. So your flame is the little diaphragm inside here, and the sound goes in, jiggles the diaphragm, and the flame jiggles up and down, and that's what it looks like. A, B, different frequency, and A plus B. Do I hit for this? How do I make the... There's a little sound recording down the lower left-hand thing.
Get a cursor. Here's your mouth cursor.
Okay, I can't see the cursor. Can you?
It's
oh, it's down. Oh, this modern technology, I tell you. Anyway, that's what the flame looks like. So you're beginning to be able to see the structure and the sound in addition to hearing it. Alrighty. This is the thing that followed this device here. They said, well, why don't we put together a bunch of resonators and then have six flames, possible flames, hooked up to the resonators, and you put the sound into it, and all the little flames are jumping up and down, and you turn a crank, and there's a mirror on that shaft there. So you're looking at six traces at the same time. It's like an oscilloscope with six traces. And, okay, next. And now we get to the phonodeque. This one he invents. And what there is, that the sound goes into the horn on the left-hand side. Then there's a little vertical shaft there. And there's a tiny thread, there's a diaphragm that jiggles back and forth with the sound, and there's a tiny thread attached to the diaphragm, wraps around this little shaft, and glued to the shaft is a tiny little mirror. So you shoot a beam of light at the mirror, and the shaft is going like this, and you have a camera with the film being moved like this, and you get the traces that you're going to see. And I think it goes back to Peter at this point. Do I have another one? Okay. Oh, yeah, of course, we do. What did he do with the phonodeque? Well, you can see he's in a position where he can make some money. He goes to the phonograph companies and say, I will compare the sounds as produced in the auditorium where the recording was made and that played by your device. So there in our Rockefeller building, which is still existing, is his laboratory with a whole bunch of phonographs, and he had it with radios and you name it. On the left, you see his that little horn is set up with his phonodeque, and he's got cameras there, and it's sitting on a brick column, and that's on the third floor of the building. He built all the way down, the brick column goes all the way down to bedrock. A few people in the building even know that. It's still there to keep it vibration free. And then, of course, this is a device made originally in Switzerland, or it was manufactured in Switzerland, the Henrici Harmonic Oscillator, Analyzer, sorry. And on this, you will have a plot of the wave that you're interested in, and you just move what was like a mouse along the plot, and there are lots of strings and pulleys and so forth, and the result is that you can read out the contributions of each of the different Fourier frequencies. So it's a Fourier, it's a mechanical Fourier analyzer. And so he got one of those. He bought it from a fellow in Switzerland and played with that for a while. And then, given the results of the Henrici, he knew what the various Fourier components were, the amplitude for each component. Now the question was to feed those amplitudes back in and make a drawing of the wave, just to test, just to have a record or a way to look at the behavior of the system that was measured. And so that's this device. There's Miller's down at the end there. He's a little bit older now. He's in his 60s, and he has this enormous thing. And his undergraduate said, well, we'd much rather set all these set screws on all these pulleys here to feed in the Fourier amplitudes. And then you turn a crank, and it draws the appropriate curve. And the student said, well, it's a lot better than sitting there looking up all those sines and cosines. And now I can turn it back to Peter. Peter was my student a few years ago in nuclear physics, and I'm sure that's why he went into acoustics.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, so the phonodeic was specifically designed for the analysis of sounds, as opposed to playing back the sounds like the phonograph. So Miller knew, of course, about the other sound recording systems. He knew about the Scott Koenig phonautograph, the Koenig manometric flame that you've seen already. There's also the new oscillograph. You took the Bell telephone microphone and you plugged it into this electromechanical device. And you could also, it also had a mirror that was shaken by a magnet, electromagnet. And that could make traces as well. And of course, the Edison phonograph and Scripture and Hermann and Bavier would trace the phonograph records. These all made nice, listenable records of sound, but they weren't satisfactory to Dayton Miller for the analysis of the sounds. So he says, the investigation of certain tone qualities, that is to say, what makes a French horn different from a flute? What makes an A sound different from an ah sound in vowels? What makes a silver flute different from a wood flute? These things are the kinds of tone qualities that interest Dayton. And he says they required records of sound, sound waves that show greater detail than had heretofore been obtained by these other devices. All right, so here's an example of the phonodeic trace. Now this is recorded on a piece of film that's about a foot long and several inches wide. And so there's an information limit to how much you can store on one pass of this photographic trace. So I have digitized this and this is great. This is him saying a Bureau of Standards, right? And it looks really interesting. You know, we hadn't really had this detail. Let's take a listen to what it sounds like. This is just the first line, Bureau. Okay. All right. So that doesn't sound great, but you do get the amplitude variations. But the problem is that for a long utterance of this sort, the waves are too close together to get really any detail out of it. So it's not really useful for analysis except for looking at the amplitude variations throughout the sound. Most of the use of it was to look at repeating waves. Here are our three vowel sounds, oo, e, and ah. And so we would look at a repeating pattern that we could then analyze, or he would then analyze. Right, so this is in the early 1900s. The phonodeic was invented in 1908. Is that right? That's right. All right, so the complete loop then would be we record the sound with a phonodeic, And then the next step would be to analyze this repeating pattern for the harmonic frequency components, F1, and then twice that, second harmonic, three times that. So here's an example of a waveform, and then we analyze it. So this waveform contains the first harmonic and the second harmonic and third harmonic. This is called the Fourier analysis, and the Henrici analyzer that Bill showed you a moment ago does that analysis. Then, because this is important for reproducibility, he needed to understand the response of the phonodeic, and so he would make corrections to his plots by measurement of the phonodeic response. Here's a trace. So the phonodeic makes the sound, makes the light wave go up and down, the light beam go up and down. So what he would do is he had 92 organ pipes from 64 hertz to 12,000 hertz, and he would play one of, and they were all adjusted to uniform loudness, and so he would play the first pipe, 64 hertz, and see how big it vibrated the beam, and then he'd go to the next pipe and see how much it vibrated the beam, and so this, and so this is a note-by-note measurement of what the response of his phonodeic is, and then he would plot these curves. This is frequency on this axis and response, and so you would get these response curves so that he would know how to adjust these measurements that he had made for the components to get back to the original. All right, so then once he made that correction, then he would resynthesize the waveform either on paper or to sound, and so in paper, Bill showed you the harmonic synthesizer with 30 different components, I think. To play back the sound, there's the Koenig siren, which is a bunch of holes with wheels with holes in them that you can adjust the amounts of each harmonics, or the Helmholtz synthesizer, which has about 8 different tuning forks of different frequencies, and you can adjust the amplitude that each one plays out. This is the state of the art, and it wasn't very good, really, right? So we'll do better today with that. All right, so let's go through these pieces a little bit. The Henrici analyzer, this job is to analyze the harmonic frequency components of any waveform. This comes from the theory of Jean-Baptiste Fourier, who said in 1822, so just about 75 years earlier, he said that any waveform can be described as some sum of sines and cosines of harmonic frequencies. So as an example, this is a trace that Dayton Miller did. Here is a face, a profile of a face, and so if you draw the profile of a face, that could be a waveform. And so you can compose this out of a certain amount of this first harmonic and that second harmonic and so forth. And so he then took this profile and analyzed it with a Henrici analyzer and came up with these amounts of sines and cosines. And then I didn't show you here, but then with the synthesizer, then he could redraw it and it would get exactly the same shape. So you can take a sound wave or any waveform and decompose it into its sines and cosines components. Usually, we would look at one cycle of a repeating waveform, although that's not necessarily true, but that's what we would usually do. Each component of these, the amplitude is calculated by you have to take the curve that you've got and you have to multiply it point by point by the shape of the sine and by the shape of the cosine, adding up all those points together, and that would take hours and hours to do by hand. But with this Henrici analyzer, you could take any waveform and get these components out in minutes. So that was a great tool. Once you have the waveform analyzed, you can put it back together. And here is this same profile put together in repeating waveform. So you could actually play the sound of this face if you wanted to. All right, so here's an example of an organ pipe sound and the about 16 components, how much of each of the different ones. So Dayton describes the shapes of these waveforms. He says, in this sense, beauty of form may be likened to beauty of tone color. That is, to the beauty of a certain harmonious blending of sounds. Okay, all right. Okay, so we have a few videos of the Henrici Analyzer in operation. I want to thank Roger Hansen and Joel Hawk and Ed Kotick for putting these together. So here is how you use the Henrici Analyzer. Ed Kotick is sitting.
When?
You can't see that, but I can.
I think I'd move as fast as you can.
Let's see. That's interesting. Let's see. So, Michael, do you have any suggestions?
When?
I've got a video on here that I want to show.
As you can.
This was working earlier today.
When?
That's the video. Ah, okay, you can drag it over there. All right, thank you very much. Okay,
when?
Thank you so much, Michael. That's great. All right, so along here is the waveform that he's trying to analyze, and so he's dialing these two dials at the end, and here's a little cursor that he's using to follow along the waveform, and there are balls here that are rotating, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
when?
For the five different components that he's analyzing. We'll get another look at those in a second.
I think I'd move as fast as you can. When?
Oh, it's repeating itself. We don't want that. Okay, let me see if I can stop that.
I think I'd move as...
All right. Now here's another one. Let's see. Okay, so I don't understand how this works. That's not it, that's not it. I'm obviously in need of help again. Michael, thank you, Michael. Okay, so I want to play each of those.
Okay.
Of course, at the rehearsal this afternoon, it worked perfectly.
I'm going to try.
And we congratulated ourselves a little bit too early, I suppose. But Michael's here.
Okay.
Beautiful.
So you want to play the second one now?
It should be good now. Excellent. Yeah, okay.
Go.
There we go. All right. So here you can see the...
You're supposed to say action, Roger.
And so here you can see the
right. Sorry.
These balls rolling as he turns the knobs.
I'll do that. Go.
Okay. And then you can get the next.
We're on the slowest.
The next five
speed
harmonics.
Now, moving on a sawtooth. Now we're going to stop and move over to the next higher speed. There. And now he's starting again. And they're moving at a much faster rate.
Okay.
There is a third one, but we won't. Show that would make it move faster. This would. Okay.
All right, so here it is from the back then. You can see the balls moving. This is Roger Hansen and Joel Hawk.
Okay.
All right. What's that? Let's just do one more. All right, so here you can see there's a cosine term and there's a sine term over here, and these little dials then add up the components as you go along the curve. Okay, So that's his device that he used for the analysis. And then, as I said, we can synthesize it with a similar device. The harmonic synthesizer is the same thing in reverse. Now, what we're going to do today is play back a few of these phonodeic traces. We will take one cycle of the repeating waveform that we've digitized, and then we will do Fourier analysis to get those harmonic components, just like the Henrici did. We will resynthesize a single cycle, and then we will repeat that single cycle to get many cycles, so we get a couple seconds. Each cycle is about 0.04 of a second, 0.004 of a second. Then we'll repeat that, we'll extend that to get about 2 seconds worth, and we'll play that back. So this is basically the same process that he would have done, but we'll take our digital computers to do many of those steps because we don't have the fancy mechanical devices. I should mention also that I don't have the correction curves for his particular traces, so I'll just leave them uncorrected. The other thing is that as we play these, an important part of the timbre of a sound is the attack transient. And so we're just listening to a piece in the middle of the sound, and we're missing that important attack transient. So they won't all exactly sound what you would think a flute would sound like. Here's just some simple tuning fork examples. So here's the waveform. This is a pure tone. And then here I have the analysis. This is component number and amplitude of that. And so this pure tone has only one component. All right. Here he's put 4 into a chord. So here is the root, the major third, the major fifth, and the octave. Notice that though that repeats 2 octaves below the root of that, and so the repeating pattern is actually this guy down here, which isn't present in the sound, but you hear that pitch. Here is 2 tuning forks together, this one and this one, and when you play them together, they create beats. And again, you might be able to hear that same pitch as this original one. All right, so here's a flute. This flute's actually played mezzo forte or forte, so it's got a couple components in it. Again, you're missing that attack transient, but a softer flute would have a purer tone. Here's a clarinet. So that's the clarinet. Typically has a strong first and third component, but a very weak second and fourth component. Here's an oboe. Okay, a little bit richer. And here's a saxophone. Right. Here are some brass instruments played much lower in pitch. This is a trombone first, and then a French horn. Okay. Again, you're missing that attack transient, which includes a lot of important information. Now, here are some vowels that have been analyzed. This is the first one is gloom, the oo sound. All right. The second one is b, the e sound. And this third one is actually Dayton Miller himself giving the ah sound in father. Okay, so we actually have his voice there. Notice that his pitch actually was a little higher than the others, and so that's shown up in a few of the traces. Here are some examples of non-repeating samples, non-periodic forms, waveforms that we haven't analyzed in the same way. And if we played them back, they would give that same static as before. I won't bother going through all those in detail right now. We looked at profiles before. Here's the French horn waveform. Dayton Miller said, well, if you turn that on its side, it looks like another face, doesn't it, kind of? Maybe a gentleman with a mustache and a Roman nose. Here's another waveform. This is a saxophone. If you turn that on its side, Miller called this the three-jawed crocodile. You can kind of see that over there. Okay, so that's all we have for today. We hope you've enjoyed our little tour of Dayton Miller's life. I don't know if we have any moment for questions.
We can take one or two questions. You seem to be calling the fundamental the first harmonic. I thought
yes, the fundamental is the first harmonic.
I thought the first harmonic was an octave above the fundamental.
People have different names for different things, but typically the fundamental is the repeating first harmonic. Yes.
All right.
I seem to remember from your website that you mentioned how much the traces matched after Dayton did his analyses. In other words, when he did the analysis. And it was an incredible matchup, right? Like the accuracy was extremely high.
Sure, we're exactly reproducing it. The Fourier analysis says you can exactly take something apart and put it back together again. Yes. Yes.
If there are any further questions, you can see the gentleman at the end. Thank you.
Thank you.